start by welcoming the officials of the National Nuclear Regulator, as well as honorable members, everybody present, the press, PNG, and that. As it is the custom of the committee, everybody will introduce himself or herself, and with the other things you can leave, like your ID number, the place that we were born, and how many wives, how many girlfriends, how many kids you've got, and that you can leave for today. Just your name, surname, and position. That's all. From where you are, whether you're from the Shalowa, the Kota faction, that we can also leave today. We're not going to bother about that. My name is Freddie Adams. I'm the chairperson of the Committee of Economic Development, which comprises of the cluster, economic development, mineral resources, and energy. We are also clustered with trade and international relations. It comprises of trade and industry, tourism, and international relations and cooperation. I'm a permanent delegate from the Western Cape. Let's start to my left.
Bafunani Aaron Mguni from the Free State.
I'm Richard Davis. I'm a journalist with South African Press Association.
I'm Tumsani Kamete from KwaZulu-Natal.
I'm Money. I'm Maxwell Godefalo from Limpopo Province.
Morning, Shirley Chen from Harten.
Good morning, I'm Elsa
Finlingen
from the Eastern Cape.
Goedemorgen, my name is Colin Mayne from Northwest.
Kenneth from Cape from Northern Cape.
Okay, the same with Summit from Committees.
Justin Bombrimon from the Saga National Parliamentary Office.
And he keeps it at PNG.
Tim Hill, National Nuclear Regulator, Manager Kuberg Program.
And my name is Joe Mwase. I'm the Executive for Strategy and Stakeholder Relations for the National Nuclear Regulator.
My name is Nokhi Sevenzi. I'm Chief Technical Officer of the National Nuclear Regulator.
My name is Tabitha Bauer. I'm the assistant to the secretary.
Now we know who everybody is, who's who. Members, we've got three items on our agenda. We've got the briefing by the National Nuclear Regulator, consideration and adoption of the Oversight Report Northern Cape, discussion of the 6th Annual Conference of the Democracy Development Program, DDP. Now, if possible, we would like to finish by 12:45, because members have got some other things that they need to do before the House starts at 2 o'clock. So I'm handing over to NNR to take us through the program presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Before we start, we just need to give apologies from our CEO. Advocate Nkize is down with the flu and could not join us. We have come to represent the organization. I think Mr. Nsebenzi and I are in the executive, reporting directly to the executive to the CEO. So what we say today is representative of the organization. Thank you, Chairperson and members of the Select Committee. What we'd like to cover today is just a brief background about the National Nuclear Regulator. I believe this is the first time that the committee and ourselves have interacted. So we'll just paint a background of who we are, what we do, how we do it, and that should possibly allow for a lot of questions about exactly this entity. And then we'll go to talk about how we license new nuclear sites, and that portion will be handled by the Chief Technical Officer. So without any waste of time, I'd just like to get through to with the presentation. The National Nuclear Regulator is established in terms of the National Nuclear Regulator Act. What it does, it exclusively deals with the regulation of the nuclear industry. It's important for committee members to be informed that in nuclear, there is the industry that does the promotional part of nuclear energy. And our task as an institution is to regulate for the safety of the industry. The basic mandate of the NNR is to provide for the protection of persons, property, and environment against potential nuclear damage. As set out by the law, what we basically do, we set up safety standards and pass regulation through the Department of Energy now. What we also do to accomplish protecting people, property, and environment against potential nuclear damage is we would issue nuclear licenses to any person or any person in the Republic who wishes to handle nuclear has to apply for a nuclear license. We also issue what we call certificates of authorization. These are largely issued to the mining industry because they are not, they don't actually get what you call a nuclear license. They are called a certificate of registration, of authorization, and I'll talk about more about that later. We also conduct compliance assurance inspections throughout the facilities that we regulate. And when necessary, if there's deviation from conditions of license or any part of regulation, we then have to take the necessary enforcement action. The NNR, the way it is structured now, we regulate the entire fuel cycle, basically from exploration of uranium right up to decommissioning of a nuclear power plant. The fuel cycle itself we view as beginning from the time a person wants to apply to explore for a uranium mine. They have to approach us. We've got to be involved from the licensing from there. When they run the mine and the milling, if there's any enrichment that happens, it falls under our jurisdiction. Similarly with fuel fabrication, the actual operation of a nuclear power plant or a research reactor, anything, the waste management that has to be dealt with from the use of power plants and other nuclear facilities, and any decommissioning will fall under our jurisdiction. Currently, the facilities and actions that the NNR regulates include nuclear power plants. We've got one operational nuclear power plant, which is Quebec, and there was the PBMR, which has since given us a notice that they won't be continuing to set up a power plant. We also regulate research reactors, which are largely known to be based in Pelindaba. We also regulate the waste management repository, which is down in the Northern Cape in Falfort. The mines and scrap metal dealers also fall under our jurisdiction. And then we also regulate nuclear vessels. I just want to talk a little bit about the mines and scrap metal dealers. In the production of gold, there's always a byproduct of uranium, especially in South Africa. So we have to license the mines because workers get exposed to radiation when they work underground. So it is in this context that we're not the ultimate authority to license the mine, but with respect to protecting workers who mine the gold to get exposed to radiation, we have to license it. And also, mines will handle radioactive material. Anyway, they're likely to contaminate the environment. We scrap metal dealer. Typically, in a scrap metal dealer, they handle all sorts of material, and radioactive material has a way of finding itself to scrap dealers as well. Now, this is quite important for us to regulate because exposure of the public to radioactive material could be quite dangerous, and our mandate is to protect the public against such exposure. Nuclear vessels. There are two categories in terms of nuclear vessels. you either have a nuclear-powered vessel, typically these are naval ships that use nuclear power to propel themselves. We would regulate those. If a naval vessel from another country was to come and anchor in South Africa, we would have to issue a license for that. The second category of vessels is any vessel that carries radioactive material, that has radioactive material on board, must apply to the regulator for a license. And we would set the regulations, transportation regulations, how to handle the cargo on board, because it does constitute some dangerous goods. Just to quickly move to the sites that we regulate. Geographically, there are three distinct nuclear sites, excluding the mines that are all over the provinces. There is Pelindaba, which is down in Pretoria, which we manage, which we regulate. There is the Kube Power Plant here in the Western Cape, and there's the Falput site in the Northern Cape, which we also regulate. And I'll talk a little bit about the activities that we do. Just to provide pictures, that is the Kube Power Plant, a few kilometers from here. Those are the Pelindaba facilities down in Pretoria. And that's the waste repository in the Northern Cape. And then the mining industry, that is usually classified as naturally occurring radioactive material. So all the gold mines, all the uranium mines, typically we regulate, as I've mentioned. Now, just to talk a little bit about what we do on a day-to-day basis. In all of those facilities, we've got a team of inspectors who conduct compliance assurance audits. When a facility applies to have a license, let's take, for instance, Quebec. When Quebec was given a license, there were conditions for their license. Basically, the conditions set out the kind of safety procedures, how to maintain safety in the operation. So we then have to get inspectors to go and conduct assurance inspections that Quebec is keeping to those kind of standards of operation. On a daily basis, we would have inspectors throughout facilities. Similarly, in Pelindaba, we've got inspectors who go there, and the mines, we've got inspectors who visit the mines. Every month, you have literally reports that tell you about the status of compliance. And this information is further published in our annual report. We would make information available in terms of the inspections and the findings. In cases where there is non-compliance, we would have to issue a directive. One of the cardinal principles of regulating the nuclear industry is that the primary responsibility for the safety of operating the facility lies with the license holder. So when we give you a license, it is your responsibility, it is your legal duty to make sure you operate it safely. What we do as a regulator is to provide assurances to the public that you are doing exactly what was set out in your license conditions. If you do not comply with that, we are entitled or we are empowered as the regulator to even shut down the facility. So if we perceived that safety conditions were not being observed by the management of, say, ESCOM, we are empowered by law to direct them to shut down the facility. So that is our primary responsibility. What we then have is we've got these existing sites that we regulate. But we all are aware that the Department of Energy has been speaking about potential nuclear expansion. As a nuclear regulator, what we have done is to look at if South Africa was to have a new nuclear power plant, we have to be ready as a regulator. Now, we are preparing ourselves in case there is a power plant. And up until now, we haven't received any application that anyone wants to build a nuclear power plant. but we are aware of the discussion. The moment we receive an application, that's where the regulatory process is likely to start. I'm going to hand over to the Chief Technical Officer to just brief the committee on the type of activities that we are undertaking to prepare ourselves in case there's a new site that we receive a new application.
Thank you. The licensing process covers the whole range of activities from the siting of new nuclear installations right up to the decommissioning. As you can see from the table here, we also look at the design of the particular proposed nuclear installation, look in depth into the safety aspects of it. What we typically do, as you probably be aware, that the nuclear industry is probably the most regulated industry, arguably the most regulated industry in the world. I think that hence all the talks about the countries that are perceived to be non-compliant and so on. So we subscribe to the, South Africa is a member state of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which sets global standards. So a lot of what we do, our national standards, are basically based on the IAEA rules and regulations, of which we are part to. We are part of the formulation of those rules and regulations because we're members. So we base our standards on that. So we look at the design, and we typically have technology that comes from a particular country. For example, if we opt for American technology, we would, as a regulator, team up with a regulatory authority in the United States who have spent hours and resources looking at a particular design. We have got agreements, bilateral arrangements, where we can share in that knowledge. I just need to say, in the nuclear industry, there is a general understanding of sharing of information. They have second to none, because there is a general perception that a nuclear accident anyway is a nuclear accident everywhere. And therefore, for that reason, even the most proud nations are willingly sharing their information and their experiences in terms of what they have seen. So for that reason, we have that comfort that even if we do get a new technology, depending on what country it's coming from, we've got access through the regulatory authorities of that country to share in that experience. But nonetheless, we still need to customize it to our own environment, to our own situation. Then, of course, the construction, which also covers manufacturing and the procurement of items. And let's just maybe mention that when we were looking at the PBMR before it was put on hold, we were even looking at some of the manufactured items, long lead items. We were even going to countries where they were being manufactured to make sure that they are compliant with the nuclear safety regulations that we put in place. And then the commissioning of the various plants, of course, the operations that now for many years. And whatever modifications might be required, as technology moves on, sometimes you need to modify a plant because some plant in Spain or some plant in France is found out that that valve needs to be modified in order to improve safety. We incorporate that in our systems here as well, that kind of thing. So that's how extensive the sharing of information is globally when it comes to nuclear. But of course, the decommissioning, as you will probably be aware, nuclear materials last long periods of time. Then, of course, you've got opportunities for typically what happened with Quebec. It was an application for a combined license. In other words, covering all the aspects of siting, design, etc., into one license. But we've got capability of looking at separate aspects of licensing. We've spoken about the National Regulatory Act, and from that act, which is an act of parliament, of course,
we have good regulations which are the custodian of the our respective authorities, the Department of Energy, that is responsible for the regulations. And then we do issue authorizations to operators, and then we also publish requirement documents. These are the various rules and regulations that give effect to the act. Because the act is a high level document, obviously, but there are the do's and don'ts, the technical nitty gritties that we need to put in place. And then, of course, the radioactive waste management policy and strategy. And I'm sure you are aware that the Radioactive Waste Management Institute was actually established, but it's not yet operational. It will be responsible for radioactive waste. At the moment, NEXA is responsible for the Valsus plant, but it is envisaged that this will go over to the National Radioactive Waste Institute in future. We are well established, although the Act of the NNR is the 1999 Act. Prior to that, there was a Council of Nuclear Safety, which used to reside at Pelinda, and eventually moved away from Pelinda to Centurion, but still as Council for Nuclear Safety. It then became National Nuclear Regulator in 1999. But that does not mean that there was no nuclear regulation until then. So it's important to note that since the beginning of our nuclear involvement, there has always been regulation. This is just to show you the various documents that we publish, that we have at our disposal. All our operators are aware of these documents, they use them. And in fact, the process that we arrive at in getting these documents out. As an authority for setting standards, we do not do it behind closed doors. We use international standards to guide us in terms of what rules to put in place. We circulate these documents to the industry for comments. So it's a consultative process. At the end of the day, the standards are national standards which are arrived at through some sort of consensus, because the objectives are the same in terms of safety to the public and to the workers. So this is just to show you the myriad of documents that are available to the operators. We have drafted a document with regulations for the new nuclear installation. It is now in the process of being formalized through the Department of Energy. It was sent out for comments to institutions or related institutions like ESCOM and NEXA. It was drafted the document for the control of zones around nuclear installations. Maybe I should just say a little bit about the issues pertaining to the zones around nuclear installations. Because of the strict regulation and the requirements for emergency planning, we do set rules in terms of what needs to be in place within a certain radius. For example, we do have an emergency planning zone of 16 kilometers for Quebec. This is in the unlikely event of a nuclear accident. The emergency plan should be We need the Quebec Power Station, ESCOM, to produce or to prove to us that they can evacuate people and workers within acceptable time period. And as a result of that, every 2 years between NEXA and Quebec, we alternate the years, we do what are called emergency exercises. We simulate a nuclear incident, and we test the preparedness of these institutions in terms of doing the evacuation. So we have, in fact, drafted a document to guide us when we get to the stage where we are going to be looking for sites
or licensing sites for new nuclear power installation. We are also looking at our current regulations and guides in order to obviously to improve on the way we are delivering. And especially because we are on the eve of a nuclear renaissance. We've been talking about that. We talk about new nuclear generation. We've been talking about increased mining activities in terms of because of the worldwide increase or interest in nuclear. And therefore, we need to respond with adequate regulatory framework and a capacity to be able to meet with those challenges. So we are looking at all these things with a view to improving. That's really basically what we're saying in this slide. The regulatory framework that we're talking about really basically looks at the existing national or international framework. As I said before, we base all that we're doing on IAEA guidelines and on international best practice. And then the experience that we've gathered over the years, the many years since the 60s that we've been operating Kube Power Station, we've gathered a wealth of experience that we plow back into our standard formulation. And then the various standards and regulatory principles and safety guides and indicators. The choice of technology, it's important that we emphasize this point that as a regulator, it is not our role to decide on what technology the country is going to go for. Eskom is the operator, basically, and the Department of Energy is the authority that is responsible for promotion of nuclear energy, of energy in general. Between Eskom and the Department of Energy, they can decide on what technology to buy, where to buy it from, whether it's from China, whether it's from the United States, whether it's from Europe. That is not entirely up to the regulator. We step in when a decision has been made to say, how do we then regulate? Our only bit of input might be to say, if you choose this technology versus that technology, this is the implications in terms of licensing, because maybe this is new technology or first of a kind technology, it would take us longer. If you choose proven technology, there is already experience somewhere that we can take shortcuts or arrive at answers quicker. So that is about the influence that we can have as a regulator in terms of our input. Besides that, it is between the operator and the government to decide what technology we choose. Having decided which technology, there could be influence in terms of, for argument's sake, if you take all proven technology, before systems of safety were improved dramatically, you may require a bigger emergency planning zone. If you choose modern technology, which has been proved to be a lot safer than technology 20 years ago, where you may not need 16 kilometers, you probably need a lot less emergency planning zone. That could be an advantage. But all those considerations are not part of the regulatory prerogative. It is really, those are economic considerations that lie in the hands of the operator and, of course, government. But where we come in is to say, if you decide to go this route, this is what you must comply with. If you go that route, this is what you must comply with as a regulator. As I was saying, in terms of the impact on sizing the emergency planning zone and the economic considerations of building an isolated power station where there is no economic activity, some of the issues that confront or that challenge us in this country is this whole issue of private ownership of land where these power stations are located. We have found in our experience that countries that have, where the government owns the land on which these sites are identified, have a lot less issues to contend with. Because you can imagine that if you've got a nuclear power station and a private investor has got a land a kilometer away from the power station,
in a democracy like such as we have, it's a contention in court when the government or nuclear regulator says you cannot build such a facility. So that becomes another game that really is outside of our regulation. But I think from a point of view of ease with which we can regulate, it's probably best in our experience when the land around nuclear power installation belongs to the government that has got complete control of it, or at least belongs to the operator, so that they can decide on what development to put in place and how those things should be, and which are compliant with their emergency planning requirements. That's in terms of the infrastructure looking forward in anticipation of the increase in nuclear activity in this country. We will, at the moment, we were looking at 11 positions at Quebec. That gives us an idea of what we will need going forward if we have got another a nuclear installation, a nuclear power plant. We estimate that we will need between 18 and 20 additional staff to what we have at the moment. As I said before, we don't need to be doing entirely everything because we typically have these bilateral relations with other international organizations or other regulators where we can tap into their resources so that we can speed up the process of licensing. It is also important to just bear in mind that while we are talking about increasing nuclear activity in the country, we should take the responsibility of funding the regulatory environment, because any nation's regulate nuclear capability is really reflected on the strength of the regulator. If you have a weak regulator, international community generally does not have the confidence that the country can operate nuclear in a safe way. It is important that a country has a credible regulator. You will probably not hear any of the international issues about, is this country going to be able to do this or that? So I just wanted to emphasize the point that to have a regulator, even if you don't get to hear about it, because typically as a regulator, we're not supposed to make a lot of noise out there quietly, because we don't promote the nuclear energy, and we do not oppose nuclear energy. We're neutral in terms of nuclear energy. That's the official position of the regulator. If somebody who's anti-nuclear comes to our doorstep asking for information, we are obliged to give that information. If somebody who is pro-nuclear comes to our doorstep looking for information, we are obliged to give them information. We are obliged to protect the public. So this is where we basically stand as a regulator. We do participate in international organizations. We are a member of the Multinational Design Evaluation Program. We joined this group in anticipation of new build. At that point, we did not know, we still don't know what technology is going to be chosen. But being a member of this group, we have got access to information from other regulators that have embarked on similar technology. And we're looking at optimizing our resources through the licensing, securing licensing and technical support, and gaining access to other regulators, as I said before. The timeline, when we receive an application for a license, is when we really basically kick in terms of looking at the particular design that is being put on the table. But obviously, in anticipation of what is happening, we gear ourselves in terms of scenario planning to say, if ESCOM applies for a license today, we would need to put the following resources in place. We have got all those things in place, but we can't start recruiting people before we've got the budget for it. because of obvious constraints, because we typically get our fees from the applicant. That is what funds the person's effort, applying the principle of the polluter pays. The person who applies for a license is a potential polluter. In order to protect the public, that potential polluter is duty bound to pay for the effort from a regulator. That's a commonly utilized approach in regulation throughout the world. There are other models where the funding does not come directly from the operator. But these are national issues that are beyond the scope of the regulator, basically. So what will typically happen is if an announcement is made today, for us to get to be familiar with the technology, it will probably take us about 18 months. This is a base case scenario. It would take us about 18 months to thoroughly go through all the design, interrogate everything, look at all the submissions. And of course, we'll be working with whatever country of origin the technology is coming from. And then 25 months down the line, we will have a preliminary review of the case completed. And then we start the public hearing process. It is a requirement that the public has to be informed and to be involved in every aspect of the licensing process or the issuing of the license. The public has got a role to play, participation role to play. And then 30 months down the line, that hopefully has been concluded. And this is a basic timeline. Obviously, there are various factors depending on what happens. There could be a well-engaged process that might actually delay the whole process. And then the final review, depending on what has come out of the public hearings or what inputs, we then have a final review. So we're looking at about 36 months. And then that has got to go through our board for them to issue a license, and then from the board to the minister. That's essentially the kind of time that we're talking about. But should the need be, we obviously can put resources in order to fast-track the process. As I said before, this is a basic timeline. If we need to cut the time in half, maybe it might mean we need to put in three times the resources, whatever the case may be. This is a typical project management type of scenario that we can handle. The major issues and gaps that we have to address, of course, the regulation on the siting of new nuclear installations that is in progress. That I indicated that it has been commented on and is now waiting for formal adoption. And then the protection of long-term viability of nuclear sites is not part of the NNR Act in terms of the economics of a particular site that are chosen in terms of what developments are going to come out of that. All those issues are not covered in terms of the NNR Act. So those are some of the things that we need to look at nationally so that we can address them. The NNR Act allows for representations to be made objecting to the decisions of the NNR. Those are some of the issues that we have to contend with, I suppose, living in a democracy, because everything that we do in a public arena is subject to challenge by anybody, and because we've got a strong constitution. We believe in general that there should be better integration of many government initiatives. What the Department of Environmental Affairs does in terms of the environmental impact assessment and what we do. There's a relationship. Overall, what tends to catch the public eye is the effect on the environment. I remember reading an article over the weekend. People were talking about a power station being built and causing the water around that place to be warm because the water is going to be used for cooling. They were talking about it will cause all sorts of things like the squid industry is going to die. What I found interesting in that particular article was that there was actually no mention of any nuclear radiation. The issues that were being talked about were just environmental issues. That has nothing to do with nuclear. So the point is that integration between environmental issues and the nuclear radiation issues need to be managed. Timing and of the application to accommodate in another time scale. What typically happens is the decisions are not made in time. Then when the decisions are made somehow, it is expected that the NNR should miraculously just issue the license. It will be irresponsible for the regulator to just shortcut the process without thoroughly looking at the case, because any mistake that the applicant could have made, if we make a mistake ourselves as a regulator, the consequences are catastrophic. So we cannot afford to take shortcuts. We have to go through the processes. So I think in the considerations for the timing, maybe an early warning system could be a better deal. I wish it was possible for us to be involved in the safety case analysis before even a decision is made, but we can't do that because then you don't know what technology is going to be chosen. We think we're proposing that we should form a technical committee advisory group to advise the board. In other words, a group of technical experts from industry that are knowledgeable about nuclear radiation in general, nuclear technology, including even people that are anti-nuclear, to be able to put the issues on the table that need to be addressed to inform the board before they make a decision on any application. So that is the one proposal that is on the card. In fact, we are progressing very well in terms of establishing that. And then the ongoing support of by the venture countries in terms of support wherever the technology is coming from throughout the lifespan of the plant. As I mentioned earlier on, certain learnings that we pick up from France, a nuclear power plant which is similar to the Kubi power plant experiences certain technical issues, they solve the problem, we take that learning experience and plow it back into Quebec. It helps, it makes Quebec a much safer plant and generally improves on the safety of the nuclear power plant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Just to make the last rounding comments, one of the things that we do is, I think, the Chief Technical Officer mentions here, the cooperation with other regulators is quite an important part of the work of NNR, because nuclear would cut across a number of departments. We have in place what we call the cooperative governance agreement with various ministries. So if we are going to license a nuclear power plant, NNR would be acting in concert with all of those ministries. So we would have to consult before issuing a license. We have to actually speak to everyone who is a stakeholder in that process. What is also important to say, something that we have not mentioned because it's not in the scope of NNR, when you look at issues of nuclear energy, we at NNR are focusing especially on our mandate in terms of nuclear energy for electricity and all of that. One of the cooperative agreements we have is with the Department of Health. The Department of Health has a radiation protection directorate. And issues that relate to the use of nuclear energy, for instance, in nuclear medicine, application in agriculture, that they would fall under that jurisdiction. If they were public health issues, it is where the combination of NNR and the Department of Health would be quite important to explore the issues and jointly work on those. So that was quite an important matter to mention. If South Africa goes and even starts the process of a nuclear power plant, what we have at our benefit as a regulator will receive support from the IEA in terms of how to approach, would have access to technical experts the world over to be able to make sure that whatever decision we make, where the plant is going to be located, how the plant is going to be operated, would have expertise and information available to us. So we won't be operating in isolation, I think, as the Chief Technical Officer has said. Finally, just to mention one more thing that is quite important for the House to note. The National Nuclear Regulator, amongst other things that it does, we administer two international conventions on behalf of the country. The one is the Convention on Nuclear Safety. Our role is to publish a report to the international community, to member states of the IEA, on the extent of nuclear safety in South Africa. It's a convention that is legally binding to the country we published then. The second convention that we also look at is a convention on what is commonly referred to as the Joint Convention. It's a joint convention for spent fuel and waste management. That convention outlines how to approach the managing of spent fuel and waste management by any nation state. We also administer that, so we'll compile a report and typically present that to member states and subject ourselves as a country to a rigorous peer review and take comments in terms of where to improve nuclear safety. Chairperson, that is our presentation, and would like to welcome any questions. But first, before I can do that, I don't know if Tim wants to add something.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I thought Tim would have extended the invitation for the committee to go to Quebec. Tim has invited the committee to go to Quebec and for a day. So I think our next meeting with NNR will be at Quebec. Okay. Honourable members, you have heard the presentation. The floor is open. Honourable Gamere, take some hands. Ngoni. Where's the new place? But Lingan, I thought you were a nuclear expert because you were pushing us to get the NNR. So let's start with those two, Honorable and Honorable Nguni.
Thanks, sir. Before one forgets, you know, Bafana did to end his business. A good 450. So we also have today the Bafana that was doing the presentation also did well on the presentation. My first question is it advantageous to have nuclear and alternative energy in South Africa? If so, what are we waiting for? If not, what would be the challenges? Secondly, you know, when we grew up, there was this perception about Pelindaba that Pelindaba was the nerve center of the country. Hence, I'm not sure. I haven't been in that area for some time. It was highly guarded. What's the situation now? Earlier on, that there were some reports that there were people who were trying to enter in that area. Is it a higher risk area? You can just answer as far as you can. Thirdly, in Richards Bay, there is a company that is called Fosco. I think it used to be called Triumph before. And some people, and this company takes its waste right into the sea. I can't remember what they call this waste. And some people were saying this waste can be reused. But the challenge is getting a permit or a license from NNR. If you could just put some meat on that, if you know what waste is actually being dumped there in the sea for job creation that we can reuse. Some people said they could use, they would make some cement and other things and something like that. The fourth question would be, what would be NNR position on the issue of if a decision were to be taken whether by the UN or any other organization about Iran, what would be the position? And how often do you do inspections on scrap metal dealers? I've got uranium. I know in Richards Bay and Pangani, even in my small town, King and Jovo, a lot of scrap metal dealers. Now, I'm shocked today to hear about this, perceived uranium in these scrap metal dealers. How often do you do this? And if there is no compliance, what happens? Lastly, I was moved by the point of the formation of the Technical Committee Advisory Group. But my understanding was that when the board is being appointed, it would have some people with expertise on nuclear things. Wouldn't that be a duplication to have this committee? Because when you have a board, you nominate people that have got expertise in that field to serve on the board. So why would we have a technical advisory committee? We should be getting this committee from the board members. Thanks.
Thank you, Zero Committee.
Thank you, sir. My first question is on the on the presentation. I think I assessed conflicting statements when you said that you share information with any other country on the nuclear expertise or nuclear problems that you have. But then you said depending on which country it is. Now, when you say you share any, you've got access to any information on the plants or whatever nuclear problems they have, but depending on the country, which means you don't have full access to any other country. Can you just define the statement that which countries you don't have easy access to any new inventions or any other nuclear activities? Second question is on the issue of safety. Your major duty or your major objective is public safety. And you said sometimes when you're issuing a license, you do shorten the period to issue a license. According to project management, it says shorten the period, which means your critical path in this case, it involves safety. Now, don't you compromise on safety when you shorten up the period of the project. You can put in resources, in any project management, when you shorten the critical period, resources go up. But my issue there is that don't you compromise safety when you shorten the programs. And my last question is a bit on the nuclear depository at Funput. I think at some stage I read an article that I think South Africa was taking nuclear waste from other countries he is my perception true or not. And the nuclear depository in Northern Cape, how safe it is 20 years from now, 30 years from now. Because the nuclear, any nuclear waste, when it deteriorates, or when the whatever nuclear, I don't know how to put it, you know, it got to what we call in nuclear total isotopes, whatever. So when time goes on, when it decomposes the nuclear material, it forms different forms of isotopes. Now, with time, how will that affect safety of people? Thanks.
Mr. Sabenzi, you said that you have not received an application yet. However, I have reason to believe that there must have been some collusion between you and the Department of Energy, or you and Eskom, or both, because there's a fair amount of information coming out in the press that placement is the preferred site, to the extent that there's a fair amount of development going on. Now, I want to know, is there any form of protection for us when it comes to, you know, when somebody is going to commit the murder? What is happening when you want to prevent the murder taking place? You say you can only act once there is an application on the table. I believe that some of the processes are being short-circuited because of the developments that are taking place at Tafelberg. And for that very reason, I would like a site visit not only of Coburg, but the three sites where they started with one EIA and it's now basically all in favour of Tafelberg. Then you mentioned you're busy drafting regulations, or you have drafted regulations in terms of the IAEA, and I haven't seen any of that. If you can help me with a document or two, please, because you also then say you are referring to whichever type of equipment you're going to use, or technology you're going to use, it might change. But we know for a fact that Arriva and Westing are pushing for EUR wishes. Now, that is their regulations to reduce the 16 kilometers, which is the safety zone for the International Atomic Energy Association, down to bring it down to 800. And that is exactly what is happening in the Tafelberg EIA at the moment. And as far as we know, you haven't changed the regulations, so I would like confirmation of that. And I would also like to know where you publish these regulations so that I can get a copy of it. And then when it comes to the waste management, your heavy waste, where do you keep that? What do you call it? High level. How many tons of high level waste do you have at Coburg at the moment, and what is your capacity to store this high level waste at Coburg? And then, where do you take it? Where is it going to? And for that, I'll settle for that little bit. Thank you, Mr. G.
You see, that's why we called him a nuclear expert, but now I believe she's been changed now to nuclear activist.
Can I just say something about the
foot? You see there? Is that now the activist or the expert talking?
Mr. T, if we've got the biggest milk-producing district, Humanthorpe, in South Africa. We have got the biggest squid industry in South Africa, where squid is on an annual basis. That squid industry has been identified by the DTI to be as a growth industry that needs to be stimulated. And if we, as much as whisper nuclear in those two industries at the moment, it's...
What is that?
It's good.
Yeah, I don't want to look. This goes about the safety regulations and the NNR. So what we're discussing, and Mr. Sebenzi bringing in the squid and the article that he read, we cannot afford to talk about those things. But it's not relevant to this meeting at this stage. So I will get him in the passage later.
I don't know if that is a threatening sign or if it's just squid or what. Honorable Chair?
Thanks so much, Chief President. Obviously, I'm not a nuclear expert, so I'm just concerned about a certain issue. Obviously, you know, for the NNR to achieve their mandate, the inspector is playing a very important role there. So I'd like to know from your department, what is the requirement regarding the inspector's qualification and their knowledge? And as the department, do you provide them a regular training to update their knowledge on that? Second question is, from your presentation, you say the timing of application will take more or less about 14 months. How does that compare with the global standard? You know, have you got any research on that? And also, you know, with the mandate of the public set, does the department have some kind of the public awareness program as well as in place on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable St. Clair.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first question, what I suppose, is the issue about the institutionalization of this nuclear national nuclear regulator. I understand that there's a board. Can the officials maybe indicate how big is the board, who's the chairperson, what is their term of office, and so on and so forth? The second issue is the officials refer to the technical advisors that they intend to appoint to assist the board and the department to, or the regulator to do certain verifications regarding the final decisions. Now, technical advisors, you know, sometimes it's nothing more than consultants, and sometimes it's better to have that as officials in the specific institution. Isn't it just another lot of consultants that's going to cost the government a lot of money, where the department and the regulator is supposed to do it on themselves? Then the third issue is regarding the PBMR. If I understood the official right, he indicated that they only, although they are aware of the process, they only come in later. What is the engagement with the whole process involving the pebble bed modular reactor? Then the last issue is the one about the Northern Cape, and I must say that if the Honorable Van Langen's Eastern Cape doesn't want the nuclear reactor, we in the Northern Cape is very happy to accommodate it. We've also got abalone and all those types of things, but I think we will look at the greater picture. But the critical question is, with the current situation at Falpitz, in terms of the revenue potential, how much revenue is generated annually, and to which institution does that revenue go? Who actually then gets the benefit? And I'm asking that specifically because the Northern Cape, given the vastness and the geography and so on, I maintain that it's got quite a bit of potential to be used as in a responsible way as a site for even European nuclear waste. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Sinclair. Okay. Just the last one. There's been a write-up, or a water write-up, in some of the Cape Town newspapers a couple of months ago, for people complaining about Kubik. They are not protected enough. They were given small little bags, plastic bags or that type of thing, full of sand to put, or cloth some rags to put under the door or something like that. And there was a whole, I think it was in, what is that, Danefontein? The suburb around there? Danefontein and Melkbos, where residents were up in arms because they felt that Coburg or the NNR are not doing enough to protect them in case of any mishaps and that. Now, I know that there has been regular drills to that effect, but how well are the people protected out there? Because I know at one stage there was planning also of getting more houses built towards Coburg, which the city of Cape Town at the moment is still in the planning phase or on hold at this moment. So if you can just get an answer on that. Honorable Lees, did you want to add something?
Chairman, I can't possibly add anything because I haven't been part of it, but I need to apologize for my late arrival and thank you for understanding.
All right, NNR, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. We'll try and make sure we've dealt with all the questions, and if we miss any, please remind us. We're going to start with the questions. I think the first couple of questions, I'll try and repeat what they are. The advantages of having nuclear, and let me just talk about that. First and foremost, as the regulator, we do not take a position whether South Africa ought to have nuclear energy or not. We can provide information about what is advantageous about nuclear energy and what is potentially risky and dangerous. So the policy choice for South Africa to get into nuclear belongs to the Department of Energy. What we can provide the typical information that we can provide is the following when it comes to nuclear energy. Nuclear energy potentially is hazardous. It cannot be handled without proper training or competency or qualification. Now, if anyone in a country wants to even touch nuclear energy, they have to abide by the principle of seeking permission to do so because of the potential risks. There are risks that have to do with radiation. Overexposure to radiation can be very fatal to human beings. So we as a regulator, our role is to make sure that whoever touches it, we regulate strictly. And I hope that we've answered that. We can't get into whether South Africa should go nuclear or not. We accept that nuclear is here and we'll regulate it. The second issue was Pelindaba, being the nerve center of the country and whether it's high risk and the security incidents around Pelindaba. First of all, Pelindaba, as you would know, I mean, historically, it's the place where South Africa used to have a nuclear weapons program, and South Africa since took a position to abandon that program and strictly abide by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so no weapons are developed there. In terms of is it a high-risk area, we view it as, in terms of the safety of the public, Pelindaba site is not unsafe for the public. We publish annual reports to show the discharge of radiation from the facility. The security incidences that you are referring to, honorable member, there was, a year or two ago, a break-in at Pelindaba. They've since upgraded their security system to make sure that there are no break-ins. I hope that we've managed to deal with that.
There's a difference between, it still is highly guarded in the sense that from a nuclear security point of view, we do not want any port. It's a national key point for status. So from that perspective alone, it becomes a security, high security area. We can't have people going in and out and just grabbing highly not highly enriched because there's no more highly enriched, or spent fuel and doing all those things. So from that point of view, there's still some element of security. But I think the security that was alluded to was the security of the weapons program of the past. But now that is gone, it is now general nuclear security. You can't just walk into Quebec Power Station because there's the rules that place is regulated in terms of the rules so that there's no contamination. So that's to the extent that we are looking at the moment. There was a security breach, I think it was 2008. To the best of my knowledge, the jury is still out as to what actually happened. There are schools of thought which say it was an inside job. The schools of thought that it was just passers-by who took chances, who were looking for laptops. So that matter has not been resolved. Again, our role as a regulator is to impress upon Nexa as the operator to make sure that they have principle or measures in place to prevent that from happening in future. They have the responsibility for security. We just oversee that.
I'm going to leave the fourth core question for Mr. Mtsebenzi to deal with. I just want to respond to the position on Iran. The National Nuclear Regulator would not be involved at all with anything that has to do with a position or even a policy statement around the Iranian issue. That is the domain of our International Relations and Cooperation Department. We play a role in regulating internally. I hope that is answered. And how often are the inspections in scrap metal dealers? As I indicated, we've got a dedicated unit that does inspections according to a set timetable. There are various scrap metal dealers throughout the country. So literally every week, there are inspections going on. I cannot actually pinpoint how many happen a week, but there is regular inspections, and we file inspection reports to who we have seen. In cases where there are non-compliance happens, we issue regulatory directives. As I indicated, we'll actually force compliance with the scrap dealer, issuing an enforceable directive. We can actually shut down the operation if they do not comply.
Let me just add to that. Perhaps we ought to have indicated in terms of our shortcomings. I think we should be honest enough to admit that we have got certain shortcomings. What we do not have as a regulator, and we'll say that in many public forums, is the policing, if you like. We do not have the capacity to go around the country and checking everywhere that there are no non-compliance. We tend to be reactive, unfortunately, because of the lack of capacity. We tend to regulate applicants. I think to the extent that there are all these scrap metal dealers, we focus our attention on people that use nuclear material and regulate where they can dispose their scrap metal. So to that extent, Nexa cannot dispose any valves or whatever that they've been using in their plant anyway. We regulate them. So to that extent, we are regulating. But nonetheless, ideally what you should have, and this is not the only, we are not the only regulator that has got that problem. We had a workshop the other day with US regulators. They've got the same problem. That we tend, as a regulator, to deal with the honest guys that come and apply. Anybody that's doing funny things outside, because we do not have that capacity to be able to send people to say, go out there and look for everybody and look what they're doing. I think we would have thousands of inspectors. That is not possible. But that's how we do it. Make sure that is done.
On the technical committee, why would NNR appoint a technical advisory committee? The board does have a few people with that kind of knowledge, but it is always advisable to get reinforce whatever capacity you have. And let me just tackle in terms of the other question, which is related. Our board comprises of, I think, currently about 10 members. It is chaired by Dr. Tracy Cohen, who is a regulatory expert from, she used to be with ICASA. The term of the board typically is it's a three-year term of office, and the recent board was appointed with effect from the 1st of December. The aim of advising the technical advisory committee to advise the board is really to enhance the amount of technical knowledge for the board to make a decision if they were to make a call on a nuclear power plant. The issue of using expensive consultants instead of internal resources, unfortunately, it would be unavoidable to use in instances some advisors. But at this stage, the technical advisory committee has not been appointed, and I doubt if we can be able to afford expensive consultants as the NNR. I'm sure that the board will exercise its judgment to make sure that we do not incur those kind of costs. I just want to tackle the issue of sharing information with other countries, and I think Honorable Mguni was raising that. It is correct that South Africa shares information, exchanges technical information on nuclear issues with a lot of countries. However, there are countries that we do not share information with, and this is driven by our international relations and policy. Typically, countries that are not signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we do not actually have any agreement around nuclear issues with them. So the NNR will follow the government in terms of if there's any country that do not have a bilateral relation on nuclear energy matters, the NNR cannot typically have enter into that relationship. There are countries that South Africa does not have that kind of relationship, and I'm sure you'd be aware of those around nuclear issues.
Can I just add to that, because I think I probably wasn't able to express myself very well when I said depending on which country. If we choose Chinese technology, we then cooperate with Japanese regulator. If we choose American technology, we cooperate. That's what I meant by depending on which country we choose. I did not mean to say we're limited in that sense. Once, it's highly unlikely that our government, or ESCOM for that matter, would choose to get technology from a country with which we do not have relations. I can see that happening. Once our country has decided on the technology, I think it follows that we would then have to be able to talk to those people. Otherwise, it's a non-go. If we cannot share information with the regulator in the country of origin, we would be reinventing the wheel. I mean, it's not point. So when I say, depending on which country, if we choose Korean technology, we then go to Korea. If we choose European, we go to Europe. That's what I meant by depending on which country.
The issue of compromising public safety by short-circuiting the, I think enough if you can handle that. There was a question on waste from other countries and whether Falputz is safe. As far as we are aware, South Africa is not receiving waste from any other countries. Falputz receives waste generated from South Africa, mainly from Nexa and some from Kuwait. On the question whether Falputz will be safe 20 to 30 years from now, or whether it is indeed safe, we are clear as the regulator when it comes to that. Falputz site was selected after serious studies were made about that place. The study included things like whether the potential for earthquakes, the extent of the rainfall. So the site is safe. We can give that assurance that barring any catastrophic event happening, which is unlikely to happen in the Northern Cape, in that specific site, Falputz should be safe over a period well beyond 30 years. Just want to deal with the...
Yeah,
I'll say something perhaps. The safety analysis that was done for Falputz, submitted to the NNR at the time, would cover a very long period of time. You know, you have a certain allowance for half-life of the radioactive material that's allowed to be put there. And the analysis would have to go hundreds of years into the future to look at how these nuclides would eventually disperse into the environment once the containers, you know, have basically decomposed. So the analysis there takes into account what will happen in the long term and demonstrates that the doses to the public are very low and acceptable.
So the issue about public safety and shortening of the period of review, I need to state categorically that any shortening of the review cannot be done at the expense of any safety. What I meant was, in terms of project management, is if we do have an expert on, for example, high temperature effects in a particular configuration, that person may need 3 weeks to review a certain document. If, however, we throw in 3 people and they can share the spread of work, I will look at this aspect, you look at that aspect, we meet together and discuss. Together we have covered the entire, they may be able to shorten the time without compromising on the state of the plant. Under no circumstances will we accept that work that is supposed to take 3 weeks will just be taking 1 week. If we throw in resources at that work, what we are saying is that work is subdividable between 3 or 4 people so that together they can actually cut down on the time. That's what we're talking about. But it has to be done on a strict project management principle without compromising safety at all.
There's a question that was posed in a statement about the Tailspend site, that perhaps there is some level of collusion between the regulator and ESCOM, that Tailspend is a preferred site. If we can just talk generally first about the site. ESCOM identified three sites. I think Tailspend is one of them. And we know that. Currently, there is no application for a nuclear site. However, we are aware that ESCOM has prepared an environmental impact analysis study. They are conducting that. Whether ESCOM favors whichever site they favor, in the final analysis, the NNR is the one that is going to take an independent decision on that. And let me clarify the issue and put it beyond any doubt categorically. The NNR is independent from ESCOM. It will apply its mind independent of any decision by an operator. If ESCOM has picked a site and NNR finds it unsuitable or not safe for putting a power plant, we would not license that. We are willing to engage with communities around that area. NNR is going to have a separate public participation process. The public will be listened to on where a nuclear site is. There is absolutely no involvement of the NNR in Tailspend. NNR has not made a decision on that, and it can never be made without open public participation. Let me just also clarify the issue of the emergency zone. I mean, there's a lot of information, and I think We are also going to be engaging with activists, I think from Earth Life Africa and other NGOs around the taste ban issue. There are all sorts of suspicions about this matter. Let's put the minds of the this committee to rest. There is no decision around taste ban. There is no conspiracy or collusion to cut emergency zones. It can never be. We can be called to this house to account as the regulator at a point where we are beginning to process the application. So there's nothing that's going to be done in an underhanded manner, honorable member. You are entitled to some honor to this committee to come and explain ourselves. And we are held accountable by yourselves and the public of South Africa on this issue. I think I would leave the issue of the high-level waste at Quebec. I think Tim can handle that. Let me just deal with the last few things on my list and give my colleagues a chance to talk. The qualifications of our inspectors at NNR. This is the one point I think that was raised. I think it's a fair question. Let me assure the members of this committee and the South African public that the inspectors at NNR are highly qualified. Their degrees range from a minimum of a BSc. We've got specialists in radiation protection. We've got nuclear engineers who conduct these inspections. We've got highly qualified people with PhDs who work at NNR. So there is no question whatsoever whether they have the qualifications. You can only employ people who know something about nuclear or radiation. It is just one of those fields where you cannot take someone off the street and hope they will figure out this nuclear thing. So you have to actually have those kind of qualifications as a base for even entering the regulator. Over and above that, our inspectors get to a new inspector gets to work with a very experienced inspector. And throughout the year, there will be training programs from the IEA. And we enjoy good relations with a lot of regulators throughout the world. So if there's an area of technical expertise that our inspectors are not au fait with, they can be trained internationally. Typically, the way it's in NNR, people refer to themselves as scientists. They take immense pride, would actually make this kind of information available in terms of who's qualified, who handles what. There is a lot of elitism about who handles what, who knows what. So it's a typical environment, scientific environment, that you get subjected to peer review as a matter of course. So we're quite confident and actually proud that our staff is amongst the most highly qualified in terms of that. And then the public awareness programs that NNR runs, we have to work on this area, a lot of work. And today's meeting is just one of those things. This is the one area where the regulator is not really presented itself to the country in terms of what it does, just awareness about nuclear energy, radiation, and, you know, this is the one area where we need to put a lot of work. I will take a pause and let my colleagues tackle the other questions.
Thanks. Yes, in terms of inspector qualification, I might just add that we have an inspector training course, and every inspector has to go through that. And then they issue their badges once they've passed the training. I think the other question you had for me was the high-level waste. The pools at Coburg, the spent fuel pools, they have enough capacity for the present lifetime of the plant, which is approximately 40 years. And the present number of fuel assemblies in the pools must be of the order of about 1,600 fuel assemblies in both pools, so about 800 in each. And I estimate that that should be of the order of about, perhaps about 700 tons. I can find out for you during the tea break and come back to you with the exact numbers. But I think that's roughly the amount of fuel there presently in the pools, and they can accommodate double that amount. There's a tremendous amount of analysis done of those pools. There was a re-racking program that was conducted several years ago to make the extra capacity, and 3 years of analysis went into that from the regulatory, from the NNR side. I think that's me for the time being. Thank you. The other one about the... yes, I'm somewhat disappointed to hear that people feel unprotected. There is a public safety forum, by the way, that is run quarterly, and people are invited to attend, raise the issues. We'll make presentations there on any subject you want. The forum is very poorly attended, sometimes only about three people there at the forum, but we really would have expected more if people really have concerns about their safety. As regards what the NNR does, you've already heard that we have inspections. We hold Coburg to certain dose limits, maximum dose limits that the public may be subjected to from their gaseous and liquid effluents. These are very strict limits that are applied. And Coburg is monitored through their stacks and effluent pathways to comply to certain amounts that may be discharged every year. There's also environmental monitoring that is conducted by ESCOM and by the NNR independently, and these samples are analyzed, and we have not found any problem. We know there are these radioactive substances in sewage and that sort of thing, and that has been shown to come from cancer treatment, from medical applications. Any other information, you know, in terms of urban development, I think there was a concern that there are structure plans to expand the urban development further north along the corridor, and the city of Cape Town is cooperating very well with the NNR in terms of the controls of these developments in providing infrastructure for communication in the event of a nuclear accident, sheltering, evacuation, medical care, mass care centers, so everything you need for an emergency exercise or an emergency has to be in place before the developments are approved, and we are enforcing that, and the city is complying.
Can I just add to that? When it comes to Quebec and the write-up by journalists, I am not surprised at all that journalists can write this kind of story that people are unsafe. The level of information generally, and I would stick my neck out and say, generally, South African journalists are not informed about nuclear issues at all. They would quickly write things that sometimes are quite concerning without checking the effect. The NNR is willing to provide information to the public when asked. One gets disappointed when you hear sensational stories about nuclear safety issues in South Africa, and the regulator has not been given even an opportunity to talk about that. In order to allay the fears and concerns of members of the public, we conduct these regulatory emergency exercises every 18 months in Quebec. One is going to be held this year on the 30th of November. We still have the opportunity for all those who are concerned about safety issues and would invite the journalists, would invite members of the public to come and attend to actually get to see and ask those kind of questions and raise those questions of concern. We have a lot of work to do in terms of informing the public. Love to be able to speak to journalists every day to just make sure that at the least when they write about nuclear issues in South Africa, they have in hand basic facts. And if things are going wrong, the regulator will be the first one to want to know from the members of the public. So it's not surprising. It's still a new field for a lot of journalists, and we appreciate that there is a journalist here today. We are willing to have those kind of frank discussions about where things are at. No?
So the question on the Fosco Richard Bay, Fosco fertilizer, and the ways that can be used, and the perception is that the regulator is a problem, is an impediment in terms of this opportunity to reuse material for building. You know, we kind of got in between the rock and the hard place in the sense that our primary concern is for the protection of people against potential radioactive damage or radiation. All it requires is for Fosco to demonstrate to us that that material, when it is used in the form of building materials, does not pose a danger to the public, to the occupants of the building. How difficult can that be? Surely it can't be any more difficult than licensing Quebec or it can't be difficult. I don't believe that the NNR puts deliberate impediments in terms of stopping an economic opportunity like that. We are duty bound to protect the public. So anybody that is going to sell materials to the public, she must demonstrate that that material is safe. It is just that simple.
There are other outstanding questions. The regulations, in accordance to IEA standards that have not been seen by a committee member, all the regulations that we have can be made available to you. There are some that are already on the website, and you are welcome to actually ask for the specific regulation if you want to. Otherwise, you can avail the list of all the regulations that we have. For your information. I'm not going to talk about the squid industry. I know very little about squid. I think maybe Knox is more competent to talk about squid than myself. And then there was the timing of the 40 months to license a nuclear power plant and how it would compare globally. It would compare quite well. Typically, the timelines are either around that order or even longer. It is not uncommon for a regulator to take anything from 5 to 6 or 7 years to license a nuclear power plant. A nuclear power plant is a fairly sophisticated piece of machinery. To license it, you actually need to be absolutely careful and take your time to understand it. Because as the regulator, once you say your finding is that it is proven that the basic safety principles have been complied with, when you make that statement, you've got to be able to be satisfied yourself that you've checked everything. And beyond that, you have to take on board lessons from any country that has similar technology. And there's no way you can do it for a shorter time. I hope that has answered that. Yeah.
Okay. The NNR strategy for new nuclear power stations, these timelines are given in that strategy document, and that document assumes that technology has been licensed in another country. So there'll be a lot of benefit for the NNR in terms of the safety studies that have been done for that regulator. And I just want to make it clear that the technology will not be something new that is foisted upon South Africa. It will have been regulated elsewhere, and there will have been those analyses done and approval by the regulator in that country.
Can I address the issue about the technical advisory group, the committee, just to add on to what you have already said. I think the idea of this came from the fact that although people that are appointed to the board are expected to have certain knowledge. But the board typically comprises of people that have got knowledge in finances, knowledge in human resources, and risk management, all these things to run an entity. It's not just people that have got nuclear knowledge. So the specific knowledge on nuclear is a specialized field. We do have a board committee on say AMCOM, for example, on risk, on skills, on training. What do you call it? Training. Now we have got all these board committees, but we do not have a technical committee. And the work that the core business is technical. So it was identified as a weakness. If the argument that people that are on the board have got this expertise, so in fact we should not even have a training and development committee, because the board is there to do that. But the reason why we do that, of course, subcommittee, is so that we can beef it up. The technical knowledge that may be resident on board members may very well be limited. And I think if we have to have all the knowledge that we need, we'll end up having a huge board. And I don't think that is the intention. And I think to allay the fears that we just appointing consultants, I think the idea of that committee will be to have people that have got interest in the players in the industry. I can foresee a situation where some experts from Quebec, for example, from ESCOM, play a role in this advisory committee. Experts from Nexa play a role in this advisory committee from the mining industry. So these are people that have got a vested interest in what's happening, and they come together, and it's not on the basis of them being consultants, but they've got an interest in the industry, in the regulation of the industry. So they come to the table and they share notes. It's useful for people in the mining industry to understand what's happening in the nuclear generation and vice versa. So I think this will give them a good platform on which they can share information and the regulatory environment.
I think the last two points that have not been covered on the list that I have, except for the question on the squid, the PBMR and NNR's involvement in the PBMR project. The NNR, as a regulator, its involvement in the PBMR project was purely from regulating. They had applied for a license, and we had to evaluate that license, being a first-in-kind of technology, we're involved in, from day one in terms of when they said they want to apply for a license, evaluating their safety case. And now that there's an indication that they're withdrawing that license, whatever they choose to do, if they are going to mothball the technology, whatever, we'll still keep getting involved and know what has happened to all that technology. I hope that has answered that. Then the last question is the Northern Cape. Far puts, how revenue is generated, who gets the revenue, revenue from nuclear waste from Europe. As I indicated earlier, we are not aware of any external countries taking their waste to Far puts. Nexa is currently the owner and manager of Far puts. So they typically would be getting the revenue and from running that. So that's and then there is a public safety information forum also at Far puts that meets every quarter. So if there are issues around community development issues, the benefit of the communities around that, that is a forum that gets convened every quarter for members of that community to participate. Thanks, Jefferson. We hope that we've managed to cover some, okay?
Just one more. I think there was a question about, it's known that Areva is pushing for a particular technology. This doesn't come as a surprise to us, because they have got aggressive marketing. The Koreans want their technology also to be considered. So I think this, we need to be able to separate marketing aggression on one side and the decision makers, and the regulatory environment. We don't participate in the decision making of what technology is chosen. That is for ESCOM and the DOE to do. As I indicated earlier, if we are called upon to advise in terms of which would make licensing better, we will come to the party. So we're not part to that playground. We will come in when the decision has been taken to then say, okay, bring the application onto the table, we evaluate it, and therefore give the license. So whatever is happening in the marketplace in terms of positioning, who wants to push for a particular technology, we're not party to that. We cannot take a particular position in terms of which technology and so on.
Okay, members, you were answered extensively. Honorable Nguni?
One or two follow-up questions, Jefferson. Mm-hmm. On the issue of safety, say for instance, there was a site that is highly recommended for a nuclear power station or a nuclear activity. On the other hand, the community in that area 100% opposed to that activity on basis of perhaps the negative impacts it will have on the ecosystem. Let me say, if NNR was to give a license or not give a license, what weight would the community opinion have on the decision making to give a license or not to give? My second question, Chairperson, follow up questions on the PPMR. The official just said that the PMR has been mothballed or is mothballed. My question is, how safe, if PPMR were to be commissioned or part of it be commissioned, how safe is the technology that is used or the model, how safe it is, and which country did we adopt that model? South African or is it foreign? Thanks, Chair.
Any more members? Honorable Lees?
Oh.
And any more hands? Honorable Kihari?
Chairman,
any more hands?
Sorry.
Can we close?
Jim, thank you. I am coming in late, and I've now listened a little bit. Tim, you talked about a half-life for the material being stored at Falkirk, but you were quite general in hundreds of years. Exactly what is the half-life of the material being stored there? And you know, so we can get a real picture of the extent of the problem for which generation, certainly not our generation. Then I'd like to build a little bit on Honorable Nguni's question with regard to the licensing and the what he referred to the weight of the local community. If everything else is acceptable to the NNR and the only thing that is an issue is in fact the resolve of the local community that they do not want this nuclear station in their area or within a certain distance, whatever they think is reasonable, would the NNR then still issue the license?
Honorable
Nguni.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Chairperson. Mine is not a big question. So we give them like their background. They didn't mention anything about Limpopo, so I want to know their plans.
For Limpopo?
Hmm.
I can build another Pelindaba or a
PLR
or something. Okay, come on.
The building programs.
All right. What about Falina?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sabenzi understood me incorrectly. My question was not about Aziva and their marketing skills. My question was specifically related to whether if we are bound to IAEA standards, where are they written down? And what are the, I'm going to say generation three regulations at the moment. And then companies like Areva are wishing and pushing to get EUR, that's their trade regulations or wishes. They're trying to say that is actually what is acceptable for their type of technology. So I want to know for sure that we in South Africa are protected against trade and aggressive marketing, as Mr. Sebenzi calls it. So I want his assurance on tape that we are protected. Then he talks about land issues, which is what made me consider that there must have been some collusion, because he talks about areas of no economic activity and the ownership of land. Now, you know, I want to know to what extent that is going to play a role in a decision, because the sites that are currently under review are sites that were identified under the apartheid era in the 1980s when a nuclear power station couldn't be built within 100 kilometers of the Ciskei. But now we sit with Kuga, and can it be considered? I know there are other implications, and we can do that, but too, about the seismic fault and the fact that Kuga is also on a seismic fault, and that Japan also has nuclear power stations on seismic faults and so on. It's a huge big thing, but that is obviously going to be covered in the EIA. So my fears are, would the NNR only rule on safety, or would they consider other issues like economy and industry or whatever? And I've got to add that I'm adding this conversation onto Mr. Lee, Honorable Lee, and Honorable Nguni. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable NNR.
Tackle this one about the ruling on economy or industry. It is not in our mandate to consider that any economic factors. We can only consider economic factors to the extent that, for example, if a small operator is applying for a license, we would want to know that this person has got sound finances to be able to see through the decommissioning of a plant. If the government of South Africa decides with Eskom to do certain things, it's not the mandate of the NNR to consider those economic considerations. It is for us primarily to look at safety and nuclear security, the safeguards. Those are the three S's that the IAEA talks about. The safeguards at the moment are looked after by NEXA because they've been asked to do that by the Department of Energy. So we don't, as a regulator, look after safeguards. We look after primarily safety, but of late, nuclear security, since 9/11, this has really developed some eminence. So that is strictly what we are mandated to do in the NNR Act. Economics is not our forte. It's up to the operator and whoever is promoting energy to look at those aspects. Okay. What happens in the world of standards is that there are pressure groups, there are economic blocks. It doesn't matter whether it's nuclear or it's ISO or it's whatever. People have got vested interests. The human being is inherently self-interest, and that we have to take cognizance of. We have of late formed a board of African regulators to try and form a bloc that can have a voice in the international arena to counter certain regional heavyweights and have a voice of our own. These are realities of the world that we live in, whether we're talking about the United Nations or whatever. We don't have a permanent sitting on the court. So these are issues that are beyond us as a regulator per se. But I think suffice to say that that point is noted. There are huge economic interests, vested interests that all these companies have, whether it's Americans or Europeans or whatever. But as a regulator, we cut ourselves in terms of just looking at, is it safe? Is it safe?
According to IAEA standards?
Yes, according to IAEA standards. Absolutely. Absolutely according to IAEA standards. We are obviously member state of the IAEA, so we contribute in these forums and whatever. But the weight that we carry in terms of influence and in terms of our technological advancement, it's very difficult to have a very strong voice in a highly technical environment if you've got nothing to show, if you've nothing to offer on the table. At least we had a PPMR, which unfortunately, I don't know what's going to happen. And we were getting some prominence. We are one of 10 countries in the world that are part of the multinational design evaluation process. We might lose that status because we have nothing to show. So unfortunately, those are some of the pitfalls of being a developing country, I suppose.
I think the question was regarding the PBMR, how safe was the technology? I just want to say that the NNR set safety requirements in terms of dose limits to the workers, dose to the public, risk, defense in depth, and so on. So our requirements are very well documented. By the time the project was mothballed, there was no safety assessment submitted to the NNR. The NNR has not seen a safety analysis report on the PBMR to date. There have been many aspects or parts of that had been drafted and discussed with the NNR, but overall there was no analysis submitted. In terms of where the technology came from, the fuel ball, which was the main part of the safety of that technology, the containment really of the fission products were developed in Germany many years ago. Other countries have high temperature gas reactors such as the USA, so there are aspects of the technology which exist in other countries, but overall the PBMR as being developed in South Africa was a first of a kind engineering. We have to be clear on that. Oh, the other question regarding vol pits. Vol pits only receives at most intermediate level waste, not high level waste. And that restricts what they're allowed to store there in terms of the half-life. I believe it's 30 years. I can confirm that if we have a tea break. But my understanding it's a 30-year half-life. There's also a limit on the amount of decay heat per unit mass and radiation levels. And the analysis has to show that irrespective of what happens to the containers over hundreds and thousands of years, the migration of these fission products will never pose a hazard to the public. And that is standard practice. You have to look at how these will migrate over thousands of years. And returning to the earth, and what levels will then emerge. But given that half-life, clearly that will be very low. I mean, over hundreds of years that will have decayed, but not completely. And it's an exponential curve, so you always have some radiation there, but it will be low enough that once it is now dispersed, it has no harmful effect.
Any other goal for you?
I see that on the board.
Use your mic, please.
Sorry. I see on the board of directors that there is a labor expert. Now I'm wondering if the NNR only rules according to its mandate and does not include the economics at all, would it consider labor issues where it stops an industry that actually is responsible for 4,000 jobs? Not the squid industry.
Sorry, but I think the more we discuss, the more questions come up. Now, we just been told that the safety analysis of the PBMR was not done, or it has not submitted any safety analysis. In short, we don't know how safe is the PBMR, or how safe it would be should we decide to commission it again, and whether is the NNR going to require a report from the PBMR, or are they happy just that the autonomous system?
Let me clarify that.
Are there any more members that want to pose questions, Honorable Lees? Honorable Dikhali? Oh, the Dikhali. They're coming to your questions, Ma Dikhali. Honorable Sinclair? Is there a certain meeting that we should know about? Or? Oh, okay. All right. Is there any more hands? Okay, we can in and out. Please.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry, you haven't posed the question. Sorry.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine. The question of the extent to which the community refusal to have the project, that perhaps is still coming. But then, may I just then use this opportunity to build on the answer I got with regard to Falcons, okay? Where is the high-level waste being stored, and what is its half-life?
Enough.
I think in general, let me just say, there are many factors that influence the positioning of any electrical power generation plant. If it's a coal power plant, typically it's in near a coal field. If it's nuclear, it's typically put next to the sea because of the cooling, seawater and whatever, and that sort of thing. So I think Limpopo would probably be in the contention, because my understanding is that it's a water poor province. And obviously there's no sea over there, there are no coal fields. It would have been ideal if we had developed the PBMR, which is a modular reactor, small reactor, that could have been played, because that was one of the selling points. I'm not talking, not as a regulator anymore, but as an ordinary South African. This is one of the selling points of PBMR, that it was a small unit, modular, could be put just about anywhere near the places where the power could be consumed. So, and the requirements for cooling water and so on were not as stringent as the conventional stations. But then again, unfortunately, the fate of PBMR is still out there. So, to answer your question about Limpopo, again, because as a regulator, the economics are not our area, but talking as an ordinary South African, I think we need to factor all those issues from an economic point of view in terms of locating the power station. I think nuclear, conventional nuclear, knowing what we have in Limpopo, is probably out of the question.
They might national like on the waste.
Yes, in terms of the high level waste, that is stored in the spin fuel pools at Coburg, and they have enough capacity, as I mentioned earlier, for the lifetime of the plant. In addition to that, there are spin fuel containers that can be used. In fact, they're using a number of those already on the plant. Because of some, when they're doing the re-racking, they had to unload some of the fuel,
and they prefer to keep it there rather than loading it back into the pools. So it's not a problem. The fuel is very safe in those pools. There's adequate cooling and shielding for a very long time. But in the long run, the Radioactive Waste Management Institute will have to find now the solution to the long-term disposal or storage of the fuel, and that is one of the roles that they have to play. Technically, there are solutions, but it has to be established which one will be used in South Africa. And again, it will be up to some extent to the local communities whether they want to have that in their vicinity.
Can I? The United States has been talking to the Department of Energy, been talking to counterparts in South Africa with a view of taking all the fuel of American origin. I think something like 50 or so units that are currently initial fuel that is on spent fuel could be repatriated to the United States, because they're trying to to manage this proliferation. Any nuclear fuel that originated from the United States, they're trying to bring it back to the United States. There's been talks around that. So I just thought that we add this as part of the perhaps long-term solution. That has not been resolved yet, but the discussions are ongoing.
Let me deal with the question of community opposition. If I understood the question well, is if the community objects to a power plant being put in its neighborhood because of its effect on the ecosystem, obviously that's a criteria that NNR takes quite seriously. Our job is to protect the environment, and if that power plant is likely to damage the ecosystem, we can't license that. But if it is any other reason based on because we vote here, that should be left to the politicians to sort out. When it comes to, is this site safe in terms of seismic issues? Is the impact on the environment and the public in terms of health, are those issues clear? The NNR will pronounce, yes, on the basis of this, we can license the site. But if it's a question of my constituents prefers, for reasons other than safety issues, if they want to, they don't want it in my neighborhood site, the issue is their rights of the land over. So if I have bought a piece of land and I want to put something here, and it is safe for the public and you don't like that, then it really becomes difficult for the NNR to say no, because our only grounds are that there's no detriment to public health, there's no detriment to the environment. Those are what we are competent in. When it comes to the weight of the voice applies to the issues of safety. The weight of whether they like it or not, for reasons that they don't like nuclear, but the safety case has been proven, NNR will grant the license on those basis. The voice will be taken in, the weight is on safety issues.
Honorable members, are you sorry? License, PBMR license.
Let me clarify that. Honorable member, conclusion that PBMR technology is not safe, if I heard you correctly, one should say it's a very suspect position, without actually having done the technical work. The point we're making is you could not license a PBMR plant, because you have not received a case that says this is safe. So there is no PBMR plant that is going to be built in South Africa before we can satisfy ourselves as a regulator that it will be safe. If it's unsafe,
if we receive the case and we think it's unsafe, it's not going to be licensed. If they present the case and it is safe, we're going to license it. At the moment, they had applied for a demonstration plant. They never actually came through and said this is the safety case for the plant. That's what we meant. So before you even got to a stage where they demonstrated that this plant would be inherently safe, they have stopped the project. So we never got to that stage. So there is no process of licensing a TBMR plant in South Africa currently. It's not there. I hope that I've clarified.
Are you happy? Ishmael, so it means you're happy. Okay. Other than this, you're happy? Good.
I'm always happy and I have
a wonderful. Honorable Gamede? You're covered. Honorable Kihali, you're covered?
I'm covered, but we have downstairs. And, you know, Limpopo is a very good
Yeah, pretty the Coke member is gone, otherwise.
We're
only going to receive,
but you have
to. Yeah, and you have dams. So, NNR, you must consider Limpopo as dams, ne? Honorable Nyambi, you covered? Honorable Chen? Honorable Maine? Honorable the nuclear expert, you covered?
I'm leaving. I'm fine.
Honorable Van Lingen, you're fine. We don't know what you're ready for, but are you fine? Okay, hand over to you, Honorable Fallinger.
Gentlemen, on behalf of our committee, we would like to thank you for coming to talk to us this morning. We hope that this is going to be the beginning of a long and good relationship, and we appreciate what you have done so far, and we hope that we can build on this and that this morning's interview was the beginning of a platform of open and transparent discussions between us and you, and that we will get the necessary protection from you. And we can we drink tea at Schoenberg?
Yes.
Good. We're looking forward to our next appointment with you at Schoenberg. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So, NNR, is there anything from your side?
Chair, would like to similarly thank yourself and the members of this committee for inviting us. As we said, we will always be willing to come and explain ourselves on whatever questions that are in the minds of the committee. And we thank you for the opportunity to do this presentation. Thank you.
Very much. Members, and the last thing is that you and the journalists will have some coffee at Kuberg and some red wine or anything that, and kiss and make up.
Not red wine.
Not red wine. or anything else, but just kiss and make up, and no squirts also there, and that type of thing. Okay. Honorable members, we are moving to point number two. NNR, you are excused if you want to go. You feel free to do so. We're moving on to point number two, consideration and adoption of the oversight report of the Northern Cape. The report being distributed, Secretary? Has it been circulated now? Circulated now?
Thank you.
could have one. What is that one?
Oh. All right. Oliver Fabingen, you can have your caucus later. let's not get into that politics now. All right. Honourable members, that's Honourable Sinclair. Yeah. He's got to go and watch at the High Court. That's something as well. Yeah, excuse Honourable. Okay. Honourable members, the report was circulated to the members last week at the meeting of Trade and International Relations, so you had a chance of looking through it. So you had a chance of reading it and looking through it and make amendments. Can we go through it, page one? Honourable.
I did read through the report, and then the devil got into it, because I'm sure that I lost something. If you look under number one, community to year, it's ACAR. And then McDonald's isn't in plain sea of the beers, isn't the D with a capital D. And in the very first paragraph under the select committee, the third line, the social labor plans of the mine in the local government municipalities and not on. Am I right?
Page one.
Third line from the top. That's it.
Chairman, if I can just congratulate the drafter of the report, Grace. I mean, these reports are very difficult to put together when you've got politicians involved and who like to talk a lot. And so that is, I think, the important thing. Just a small thing with regard to reports, they're normally done in the past tense rather than in the present or future tense. So it's a very small thing, but perhaps it runs, when I read the report, it runs throughout the report. So that's a very small thing. It doesn't really detract from the quality of the report, but it's thank you.
Page one, let's see a few amendments that we're going to make there. Page two. Honorable Gamede.
I wasn't there, sir, but what I was thinking, I was hearing, was that the past two speakers said they've gone through the reports. And what I wanted to add was, because the reports were issued out last week, for us to do it correctly is to send those grammatical mistakes to the secretary so that when they come here we adopt and or not adopt, but not to correct the meeting in the minutes in the meeting.
I would propose that seeing that the report has been circulated and members that were given a chance to rectify, and that if there's any other rectifications, you can pass it on to the secretary, but the content of the report should be adopted. Honourable Marine, and then Honourable Ngambi.
Thank you, Chair. I was not there either, but I know that Honourable Lees and Vatlinga have been very critical on issues, but now that they've spoken,
and they seem to be agreeing with the content of the report, I would move for the adoption of the report with those things that any grammatic issues be sent to the secretary. Thanks.
Bonambi, before we proceed to the adoption of the report.
No, thanks. Yeah, I was covered when Honorable Van Lingen was to move for the adoption. Then I decided to be more fine, and I was to second her because she was moving that. When it deprived her the opportunity and gave it to my aunt.
Now, I was not depriving anybody. My aunt is got a speaking right, a right as well to speak. Am I right, Honorable Maine? I was just protecting his right to speak, freedom of speech. Honorable Van Lingen, you move for adoption, I believe. Can we accept that? Can we accept that? Okay. Seconder? Honorable Chair. No, Mr. Nyambi was not there, was he there? No. No. So the report has been adopted and seconded, and Honorable Van Lingen indeed will just help the secretary in the grammatical errors and the and all that. Is that fine, Honorable Van Lingen indeed? I think the two of you can invite each other for a cup of coffee or a cup of red wine and do it then, but not now, we want to move. Is that fine with you?
No.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Honorable members, Honorable Van Lingen, Mr. Kamai, what's up? Oh, okay. Thanks. Honorable members, point number three, the secretary has circulated this as an invitation to the democracy development program. In the past, the committee that I was chairing used to work closely with this group. And they have invited us to a provincial governance and development in South Africa post 1994. But you have read it. You've got it. You have read it. It's on the 14th and 15th of October. Do you, as members, feel the committee should attend so that we can make the proper arrangements and the necessary get the necessary political approval in that?
Resources.
Do we have resources? Well, that's why we just need to seek the condemnation of the committee to attend this, and then we'll apply for approval or if there's resources. That's it. Honorable Nyambi?
Thanks, Chair. Before making my proposal, I wanted to check whether is it a question of the entire committee attending or we want to send a delegation, because I've gone through it and I've seen that it's quite more interesting and it will be good for us as a committee to attend it. But I want us to resolve the issue of the number of people that must attend.
So far, we haven't received the, I don't know what the parliamentary program will look that time. Where there's critical issues here at Parliament, but I would also think that the whole committee should attend, because there's cross-cutting issues also in terms of trade and industry, DTI and that type of things, and also the role and impact of the NCOP, you understand, so. I mean, our provincial economic development forums and plannings and all that, so that we've got a role from this side to play with economic development. So I think if needs be, we will apply for the whole committee to go. And then the powers that be will have to guide us in terms of that. Honorable Maine, then Honorable Van Lingen.
Well, sir, I think... we should call the committee just to say on the program. I think it will be the first two when we come from recess, the heritage, that there's nothing for now. So we can apply it, and I support that the whole committee can go.
Mr. Chair, this thing about can the whole committee go? And will the whole committee be allowed to go? To me is such a strange statement to make, or a thing to understand. Because why are we X number of people in a committee, and then when we go on oversight, which is our duty, we must hear that only so many members may go on the oversight tour. It doesn't make sense, and we've got to get clarity on that. We really have to, because this is not good enough. Thank you.
Okay, we'll follow that up. Oliver Gambi?
Through you, Chair, I wanted to clarify here that for all the years, it's a fact that the number of people that are in the NCOP is not sufficient. And every time if you're going to have a sitting or there is an invitation whether you have to go and do oversight, you have to consider people that are going to be available so that you can have a quorum in the house. It's not a question of people that are to be excluded. It's informed by a program. If the program requires that in the house you can have a quorum, then you might find that you are not even allowed to go out. And if ever you have something that is very significant and you feel that you have to attend as a committee and you're going to benefit, instead of the entire committee not going, you might end up being represented for the sake of the committee.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. Is that now, you're not created. All right, we will. Honorable Gambi will invite you for tea or coffee and then explain to you the whole process. Okay, members, there has been a proposal that the whole committee should go. Can I have a seconder? Honorable Gamere, Honorable Gambi. Members, the last point I want to add on the agenda is the postponement of the oversight trip, which will have taken place next week to Richards Bay. Unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances beyond our control and also beyond the control of Richards Bay, the trip has been postponed because the one community, the Horsey, has been accepted by Cabinet, but the community went to court and they got an High Court interdict to stop the provincial cabinet to install or to have the traditional ceremonies ahead. So the court has stopped it, the High Court has interdicted that no, not one of the two horses that has been proposed should be elected. There should be a process run by the provincial cabinet to sort those things out. So due to that matter, we don't want to go and walk into a minefield and seem to be taking sides. Let the provincial cabinet, I have consulted with my co-chair, Honorable Gamede, and we were looking for the whip, but unfortunately the whip was in another meeting yesterday. So we, we have decided that the trip should rather be postponed until that matter has been resolved in that community, because it is one of the communities that the committee would have gone and see, and it is one of the big role players, Honorable Gamera, that's right, one of the big role players in that area. So with that, the trip has been postponed. We will inform you at a later stage about this. Are there anything urgent burning that you want to discuss? If I say anything urgent burning, I mean in your heart, on your mind, not like the DA Mayor has said, burn tires to stop the ANC youth. Honorable Dikhali?
This is the disclaimer. Last time we were discussing one, where is going, where is remaining,
and then... China. Yeah, the chief whip is out of town. I don't know if she has, if she's back yet. The programming, the whip will tell us. She's not back yet. So the chief whip is out of town, and we are also waiting on committee section to bring us some lower quotes because the amount were a bit too much for that. But the chief whip is out of town. The other movement that has been is that we have approached the office of the divisional managers. He has given us a bit of background on what we should and how we should go and do about it. So as soon as the chief whip is back, we'll put that ball in motion. I think when is she back? Thursday. Thursday. We'll discuss it with her Thursday, the two chairs, as you have given us that power and the whip. And we'll approach her, and then we will inform you either. But by the time we will inform you, Parliament will be closed. But your emails are open.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Yeah.
Even in Limpopo, they've got...
No,
they've got email in Limpopo.
SMS.
SMS. All right, but we will converse with you. In Mpumalanga, the technology has already been accepted there. Emails can work there.
Yes.
And in Northwest?
I
work there. Deep rural of KwaZulu-Natal. We are the first. Giving Global. I mean, if Inkanta has got emails, Giving Global must have email facilities. In Free State, is the emails working up and running? Statement, the emails up and running? See that there is a nuclear site? Okay, in Gauteng or wherever you are, top of the world. All right. So members, everything is up and running. Just for the sake of Limpopo, we'll SMS or we'll send a courier. SMS or send a courier or send Grace with a special flight up to Limpopo. Members, with that in mind, this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much. And please, members, utilize your time wisely now for this World Cup, 1.5 hours. So that we go.